Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. And on today's show, we take a look back at the Paris 2024 Olympics with Mark Dreyer, the preeminent analyst of China's sports scene. Mark, a seasoned China sports reporter, delves deep into China's performance at the 2024 Games and the cultural phenomena surrounding Chinese athletes. The discussion kicks off with a review of China's overall performance at the Paris 2024 Olympics, looking at how China fared in the medal tally and significant victories and storylines. One topic explored in depth is Zheng Qinwen's gold medal victory in women's tennis. Mark also addresses the controversies that clouded China's swimming successes, including Pan Zhenle's world record in the 100-meter freestyle. The conversation shifts to the societal impact of sports, examining the treatment of athletes as celebrities in China and the governmental steps taken to manage public obsession with star athletes. Moreover, Mark touches upon other intriguing sports developments within China, including the influence and challenges faced by North American sports leagues operating in the Chinese market. This episode is tailored for listeners eager to understand the nuances of China's evolving sports landscape and the broader implications for international sports dynamics. Enjoy.
Basically, it was a very, very good Games for China. I think heading into it, they would have been secretly hoping to top the medal table. And of course, outside of the US, everyone ranks it by golds. Now, they tied the US with 40 golds apiece. But with the, you know, going on to silver medals, the US technically won the medal table. So still number two for China. That was where they were 3 years before in Tokyo, where it was 39-38. So this is an ongoing battle. And of course, China edged it in 2008 when they had the home Olympics. You would expect the Americans to dominate in 2028 when we move to LA, back to American soil. But I am sure that China has its eye on Brisbane 2032 and thinking this is the time when we can get those Americans.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Mark, welcome back to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be back again. It's always fun to chat China and sports.
Yes, agreed. And I'm a huge sports fan. The NFL is kicking off really quickly. I actually have an NFL fantasy draft coming up later today, so I'm excited for that. And it's just the best month for sports. I think all sports discussions should be had in September because we've still got baseball. NFL's kicking off, and then NHL and NBA are right around the corner. It's amazing. September, October. Thank you for everything that you give us. Where in the world are you today that we're recording you from?
So currently, I'm actually in Taiwan. Next week, I'll be in Chengdu and then back to Beijing for a stint over the next few months. But yeah, I was kind of traveling a fair bit over the summer. I was in North America and in Europe as well. So been a busy time, but yeah, that's where I am today.
Tell us one thing. As you mentioned that, it sounds like a lot of hopping around. I start thinking about air miles and loyalty points. Is that a thing when you're traveling around Asia? I bet a lot of people would like to know that.
It is, but I think people have their different preferences. I have to give my wife credit for this because she keeps up on that, on all these sort of things. And there's some quite good things. If you get status on one particular airline, they sometimes have these matches. And so you can then match onto a different airline or, more importantly, alliance. So no matter where you're traveling, you can still kind of get access to some of those benefits. So that's a good little trick that we've benefited from
over the years. That's true. I remember I was a Star Alliance because of Air Canada, taking advantage of that wherever I could. Now, we last had you on to chat about the 2022 Olympics. Can you give us a high-level overview of China's performance at the Paris 2024 Games and any significance for China involved there?
Sure. I mean, basically, it was a very, very good games for China. I think heading into it, they would have been secretly hoping to top the medal table. And of course, outside of the US, everyone ranks it by golds. Now, they tied the US 40 with 40 goals apiece. But with the, you know, going on to silver medals, the US technically won the medal table. So still number two for China. That was where they were 3 years before in Tokyo, where it was 39-38. So this is an ongoing battle. And of course, China edged it in 2008 when they had the home Olympics. You would expect the Americans to dominate in 2028 when we move to LA, back to American soil. But I am sure that China has its eye on Brisbane 2032 and thinking this is the time when we can get those Americans. And of course, it's all friendly until it's not. You know what I mean? It's sort of interesting. And I've heard people, you know, geopolitical experts speak on this and say, you know, don't underestimate Olympic competition. And there's elements of soft power and all these things that are weaved into this rivalry. Yes, it's sports. Yes, it's friendly on the surface. But whoever does top that medal table gets to sort of flex their muscles. And I think China would secretly, or probably not so secretly perhaps, love to sort of top the medal table and beat the Americans. But this was their best performance at an overseas Olympics, obviously with that exception being Beijing 2008, when it won with 49 golds is the tally that they got all those years ago now. But in summary, a good, very solid performance from China.
You kind of touched on what I want to ask you about when referencing the number of gold medals versus the total tally of all medals. And this leads into wanting to discuss the notion of the golden obsession. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and what that means when it comes to China's Olympic team?
Yes, it's really interesting to sort of follow the progression of this as well, because over the years that I've been covering China, starting with 2008, really, and all the Olympics, then we've kind of had this ebb and flow of, you know, golds are really important. And then there's been a bit of a backlash where people are thinking, well, hang on, you know, there's been a few stories that have made the media where, you know, people are winning silvers and crying on the podium, for example. That was a famous one. And then we also have these Olympic and world champions in certain sports. And a couple of years out of the sports, they've been seen, you know, busking in the subways and basically kind of out on their ear and you know, living a hard up life. And so there's been this discussion about is this obsession with gold at all costs worth it? Some of the parents, in fact, one of the problems that China has had with recruiting of athletes traditionally from poorer areas, this was seen as sort of a great escape. You could be plucked from your local township and placed in a sports school with the longer, you know, the distant prize of perhaps winning gold for the motherland. This was seen as you know, a great honor. But actually, as China's middle class has grown and standards of living have risen, parents have been thinking, well, hang on, I don't necessarily want to send my kid away for 10 years and hardly ever see them. And he or she may or may not win a medal. And then what? You know, I want so I have different aspirations. And so the reason I'm explaining this is because it's actually really hindered China's recruitment of athletes into its sporting system, even though it's still been quite successful. And, you know, one final point on this. We've seen before various games, Chinese President Xi Jinping sort of say, you know, look, it's not about the gold medals. It's about other things. It's about sports. But sometimes that messaging is more front and center. Other times it kind of takes a back seat. And you get the sense that certainly going into a Summer Olympics where China is right at the top of the tables, you know, it's hugely important for the country and for that soft power and for that, you know, that hopefully can we top the medal table. And, you know, I remember in Tokyo, China led the medal table for most of the games and were overhauled right on the final day by the US. That's because, you know, track and there's various medals in the last 2 days that the Americans typically do well at. But, you know, it's a big topic of conversation here and in other countries as well. So, yes, we saw, I think, before the Beijing Winter Games 2022, people saying, well, it's not about the medal table, because, of course, China's not historically a dominant winter power. So there's the different expectations, of course, even though it sort of outperformed, I think, at the last Winter Games. So we see, as I said, we see this ebb and flow of, yes, let's get gold at all costs. And no, there are more important things, such as the benefits of sport for all and so on, which is, you know, personally, I think that's more healthy. But of course, you know, the whole country wants its athletes to win gold medals. And so it's quite hard to back away from that when you get to the games themselves.
Mark, I wanted to touch on something a little adjacent to what you were talking about there, which is something you said about the parents and the 10 years of not seeing them. And I wonder if, like, it's a very North American thing, potentially even a European thing, although I don't know, where you focus on sports, you try to become elite at a sport. This is going to help pave the way to you getting your education in form of a scholarship. Now, potentially you could become somewhat of a micro influencer, a little bit famous within a certain town, city, state, province, something like this. It can also help open a lot of doors to getting jobs and interviews later in life as well. So there definitely is a future and a path that is not lucrative, but it is positive if you are focused and become really, really good at a particular sport where you can get into a university via that way and potentially even join a team or do something. Like, there's a lot of professional leagues that aren't NHL, NFL, NBA level. You can certainly make money. You can certainly have a lot of fun, but you can certainly gain a lot of notoriety. So I wonder, is that something that is actually an option for athletes in China as well?
It's a great question. I would say the situation is generally quite different here. As a little aside, I just watched for the first time with my kids the classic movie Friday Night Lights, you know, where about small town America, and how, you know, if you're the high school quarterback, you're basically set for life in that town, but usually you probably don't leave it. And so there's kind of like that mentality. And of course, the scholarship for American sports is such a dominant system and so much money as well. In the UK, for example, outside of rowing, elite athletes don't really go to the top universities. They don't have the same system. If you're good at you know, our football, soccer, you're signing with one of the clubs. You're not going to university. It's just a very different system there. In China, I would say a few things. Yes, sport is still a route out to one of the sport universities. But because China is such a large country, and because they're winning 40 gold medals just at this Olympics, and forget about the silver and the bronze, how many of those people can really become legit stars? Really, the big, big names are the people who have been to 3 or 4 Olympics and are winning gold medals at each of those. And we see a handful in swimming and of course diving and badminton and some of the sports where China has dominated. You know, weightlifting is one where China racks up a lot of gold medals, but it's not really a glamorous sport. So outside of someone's hometown, they're not really going to become, as you said, an influencer or a wider celebrity. There are financial incentives for Olympic athletes, and so if they win medals, they will be rewarded often by their local or provincial governments. They'll get an apartment or they'll get some cash. And so their family is taken care of. So I think that is a big thing for a lot of these Olympians. But, you know, think of the pyramid. Think of how many divers are in that pyramid that allows China to go for a clean sweep, which it did, incredibly impressive. They're always there or thereabouts in all the diving, but this was the first time I believe they actually did a clean sweep of all the diving gold medals at the games. And quite often they were in the mix for the silver medal as well in the individuals. But think of all the divers who don't quite make the team. And then the next tier of that pyramid down and the next tier and the next tier. And you're still in China's wider diving pyramid system, but you're miles away from Olympic gold. You know, what does your life look like and what financial incentives are you getting? Yes, you're taken care of while you're in the system, but then, you know, maybe you're seen to be not good enough at 17, 18, and then you're sort of turfed out. And, you know, where do you go from there? So it is a really interesting wider discussion because, yes, a of course, some of the big names with the Chinese market can become bigger than almost any sports people anywhere because of the population base in China. But there's so many other people propping up that system that don't quite make it. And, you know, what happens to them? And I think that's a really interesting conversation as well.
It's a very unique to U.S. system because it starts in high school. High school football, high school sports, high school basketball team. You're trying to win state. You're trying to become an All-American track and field. And scouts are watching all the kids in high school. And even in baseball, whether it's Cuba or the Dominican Republic, they're tracking who the stars are. They know at a grassroots level, in starting as soon as you're a teenager, who has got potential and the data and the analytics and things that they bring to the table as well, tracking everything. Then you have also the alumni. You have TV and media. I mean, how big is college football in the U.S.? You'll have 100,000 people go to a college football game, some rival game. And then the alumni, the amount of money a university makes from fundraising from alumni to pay for the stadiums and the pools and the tracks and the fields. It's almost impossible, I would think, in this day and age for anybody to be able to catch up to that, because that is just generational.
There's actually a couple of narrow pathways that connect China and U.S. sports in this way. So, for example, in some of the sports like golf, we do see a lot of, you know, ambitious Chinese parents who get their kids into golf schools and they take them to camps. And then the pathway, they hope, is a U.S. college education. We've seen some of these people come through. We haven't really seen them make the professional ranks post college, but I'm not sure that that's the ultimate goal, really. It's to get into one of the top schools. There's a handful, I think one or two people who have been drafted into NHL teams, although they're probably still a long way from playing in the NHL, but they've been drafted. So that's kind of another pathway that we've seen. So some of these more niche sports where parents have been a little bit more selective, tennis again, and we'll talk a little bit of tennis later on. This is where players can be sort of plucked from China and then developed overseas with a goal to in certain cases, getting a good U.S. college education.
Speaking of tennis, let's talk about Zheng Qinwen and the significance of her gold medal victory at the Olympic Games.
Yeah, I mean, Zheng Qinwen, if people don't know about her, she's well on her way to becoming China's next Li Na or a worthy successor to Li Na, particularly with this Olympic win. It's not a grand slam, but I think the Olympic tennis tournament has risen in importance over the years. And this was pretty big. She's actually, as we come on air to record this, unfortunately, she's just been knocked out of the quarterfinals at the US Open. But she was ranked number 7 there. So she's a top 10 player in the world. She's still in her early 20s. She has it all. She's got an incredible game. She is a brilliant personality. She's got good English. And I mentioned that because it means that she can become a legit global sports personality in the way that many Chinese stars who don't speak anything other than Mandarin, obviously that's fine, but you know, they're not going to become that breakout sponsorship success. Li Na had a very sort of amusing level of English, which was good enough that she could give interviews on court that would have the crowds basically eating out of the palm of her hand. She was hilarious. Zheng Qinwen, not quite the same in terms of comedy, but you know, she's very, you know, very smiley, very bubbly. A lot of people warm to her around the world. And on a side note, you know, someone like Zheng Qinwen is one of the greatest possible ambassadors for China, the country that the country has, whether they realize it or not. They just need to let her do her thing and not try to make her to sort of, you know, adhere to this or that. What was interesting is that all the athletes came back. All the athletes after the games, they had a meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping in the Great Hall of the People. And Zheng Qinwen flew back from the U.S. where the tournaments, the pre-U.S. Open tournaments were taking place. She flew back for this to meet the president. She said it was a great honor and see her family for a few days before flying back to New York. And I was watching her first match. And she was really struggling in the first set. And I was thinking, oh, she might regret coming back. But she rallied and she's had a pretty good run, obviously, out in the quarterfinals. But, you know, last eight at a Grand Slam.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's one to watch. I have no doubt she will win a Grand Slam in the future. Hopefully, from her point of view, multiple ones. But she is a sponsor's dream. She already has, of course, a ton of sponsors. She's racking up both international brands and Chinese brands as well. So yes, so she is. I was going to say one to watch. She's already made it. She's won Olympic gold, probably the most celebrated gold medal of the Olympics for China, just because it was largely unexpected. You know, the diving ones where everyone had basically counted them beforehand. Tennis is a little bit more of a, particularly women's tennis, you don't quite know who's going to win any tournament. So it was, you know, great for China that she got that gold.
Well, maybe pretty soon she'll be able to rival Miss Gu on that international fame stage. Now, China also had a strong performance in the pool, but it was tainted with some controversy. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Pan Zhenle and Sun Yang and the broader situation there?
So this really began, 5-6 months before the games. And there was a story that had come out that, 23 Chinese swimmers had been training in a hotel. This was ahead of the Tokyo Olympic trials in China, the domestic trials. And 23 Chinese swimmers had tested positive for a banned substance. But what had happened is that they were all staying in the same hotel. And the conclusion was that this was contamination of their food. And so a banned supplement had got into the food of these athletes. Now, the issue here was that this was during COVID time. And so we had this sort of slightly farcical situation where the Chinese Ministry of Public Security was investigating the Chinese athletes. And this was their conclusion, which the World Anti-Doping Agency basically had to, you know, they said, well, there's nothing we can do because we couldn't get to China during that time. It was COVID. But the Americans and other nations were up in arms about this and sort of saying, well, hang on, this was a big cover up. And so I won't go too much into the he said, she said, because we don't know.
Yeah.
Side of it. But what it did, it very much dominated headlines. I was bracing, I think is probably the word, for some further controversies in Paris, where I thought, you know, there might be some bad blood between athletes, Chinese and foreign, because we've seen that in the past at certain events. I thought perhaps there might be some booing. We didn't see any of that. So that was definitely a positive. But the Chinese did complain fairly bitterly that they'd been tested much more than any other nations beforehand, and this had disrupted their preparations. And so actually, overall, the Chinese swim team didn't do that well. You know, there's various different reasons. Maybe they were disrupted. Maybe they were focusing on, you know, negative energy on the outside criticism and so on. Hard to know. But despite some of the other Chinese swimmers not perhaps performing to their best and certainly not doing quite as well as they had done in Tokyo, there was a standout performance from Pan Zhenle, who set a world record in the 100 meter freestyle men's race, and also led the team to a dominant performance and a gold medal in the 4x100 medley relay. He's certainly one to watch for the future. And again, he's already arrived with gold medals, not so much of a prospect anymore. What's funny is kind of when it comes to China, and this is not specifically a China thing, but because of the controversy around it, I think, you know, the questions have to be asked. I speak to a good friend of mine who's an international swim coach. He actually had a swimming at these Olympics. And I said, you know, what do you think about Pan? And he just kind of throws his arms up and goes, I hate it when you ask me this, because I want to believe that this was a brilliant performance. Rather than was there something more nefarious behind it? Goes, but it's unfortunately with the history of the Chinese swim team, and this goes back a few decades, you know, you do have to consider the current team, of course, will be thinking, well, this is unfair. But I think China does need to be, in certain sports, it does need to be kind of whiter than white, and it needs to be above board. And I think that this was the frustration from my point of view with the you know, the contamination situation with the 23 that we talked about prior to Tokyo, it didn't sit right. It didn't sit right when you've basically got your own country investigating a doping situation. This is not a China thing. You know, there's a situation that currently going on in tennis with Jannik Sinner, the world number one, and he's just been cleared from a contamination situation. And I'm thinking, well, it's so frustrating as a sports fan watching these rules. You can't say these are banned supplements, but okay, if you test positive, then certain people seem to get off. It does seem to be that there's different rules for different people in different sports, and there's no consistency. There's either some degree of, we can either have tolerance for, okay, if you have low levels of a banned substance, then maybe there's an explanation. Or we have this hard rule where it's, if there's anything in your body, it's your responsibility and you're out for a certain period of time. But this kind of back and forth between certain countries, and it's just a war of words. And it's, again, it's very frustrating, I think, as a sports fan to see these. And so, I'll stop there. I don't want to get too deeply involved into the situation, because of course no one really knows. But when these situations aren't dealt with properly by the authorities, it does allow for the sports themselves to be derailed. And then everyone's talking about everything else.
Well, I want to talk to you about FIFA. No, I'm just kidding. I want to talk to you about Sun Yang, and tell us a little bit about him.
So Sun Yang is China's most dominant swimmer of all time, for sure. He won, I believe, 2 gold medals back in London 2012. But then he has had two doping bans. The last one was 4 years and 3 months. So this ruled him out of Paris. He was actually eligible to compete internationally at Paris, but he was banned by the time of the Chinese Olympic trials, and so he wasn't able to do that. But the reason I wanted to bring him up is because he has since won a title at the national championships post the Olympics. Now, his time is still a little bit off world pace, but it would be simply incredible if Sun Yang, China's greatest swimmer of all time, and another freestyler as well, what if he were to make it back, and he'd be 36, I believe, in LA, if he were to get back and compete in the Chinese team. There's some questions there, because China does, historically it's had a rule where, if you've been banned for more than a year or so, then you're no longer eligible to be selected for the Chinese swim team. However, it was interesting that his comeback performance was very much celebrated in Chinese media. So there does appear to be a sort of, rehabilitation story. Everyone loves a good comeback story. You know, he's whatever you think of him, he's served his time. He's had his ban, and to be still there, it's not unheard of. Jason Lezak, an American swimmer, was back winning gold medals, winning medals, I believe, at the age of 36, which is what Sun would be in LA. So if he could come back, maybe he's in the freestyle relay with Pan Janle. It could be quite a story, and certainly it would attract a lot of attention, both positive and negative. But it would be quite a comeback.
Okay, well, there's Sun Hope.
terrible.
One of the storylines coming out of the games was the obsession with stars. Okay, the treatment of athletes as celebrities. But there were steps that were taken to dampen fans' obsessions with stars. Why?
Well, the authorities, and let me just kind of outline what happened before we sort of delve into, the pros and cons of this. There was seen to be, or deigned it to be, an unhealthy obsession with stars. And so there's too much pressure put on these athletes, and online, the comments and the chat rooms and the fans, and this leads to, it can lead to sort of, real life incidents where they're stalking out the fans' home. And you see sort of a flip side of this. There's a diver, a Chinese diver called Chuen Hongchan, who's very successful, won another gold medal, and she's still pretty young, but she won in Tokyo as well. And she is a very lively character and pretty unique, particularly in the Chinese system. And a lot of people were touring to her hometown and seeing her house and seeing where she lived. And I think she was embracing this, and the town was embracing this. But for other athletes, it's not so it's not so welcome, this attention. In fact, Pan Janlo, the swimmer that we previously talked about, he made a comment about, you know, he'd much rather have swum a little bit worse, if I believe is kind of what he was saying, if he hadn't attracted that much attention, because it's the pressure and social media and people are reading all the comments and so on. And so the directives basically went out to say, all right, guys, cool it. This is too much, you know. And again, it's a bit of a flip side, because if you're an athlete who can embrace this, well then, you know, if you want to become an influencer and a celebrity and a brand ambassador, you would welcome that attention. But I think, you know, there's definitely an argument to be had that it's not for everyone. I remember jumping around here a little bit, but I remember when Beckham came to China more than a decade ago, there was a stampede and people were actually injured. You know, we've had other incidents, safety incidents where there's too many people and crowd control issues in China, you know, where there've been actual deaths. And so you can understand why with China's massive population, this can quickly get out of control, whether online or in real life. And so I do understand, why, as I said, steps were taken, but sometimes it can be seen as a little bit too, you know, come on, they're just trying to celebrate China's sports stars. What's the harm in this? But when you have the athletes themselves saying, yeah, guys, this is too much, you know, I think you also need to listen to the athletes as well.
Last question, and the floor is yours. Any other interesting sports stories in China that we think the audience should be aware of?
Well, you know what? I was just kind of looking, and you mentioned at the top, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening. You have your NFL draft and NFL playing a game in Brazil. They have, they've played several games in London. In fact, there's been talk of actually putting a team in London.
There has.
They've got outreach to Germany as well. And back in the day, you know, way back before 2008, there was talk of a game, an NFL game, being played in China. Now, that idea, I think, has long disappeared. They have designated, you know, China. They've given one of the LA teams, you know, so that's China's team. So we can kind of support our international fan base and have some links there. And then I was recalling the NHL's initiative. And, you know, pre the 2022 Olympics, as they were trying to develop a market for hockey here in China, they announced that they were going to play 6 games over an 8-year period. Now, of course, COVID put a big dent on that. But I think we've only had 2 or 3 of those 6, and the rest of the initiative appears to have disappeared without a trace. But what we do have is, you know, this is the second year now that tennis and golf will be back playing in China throughout this, this autumn season. F1 came back to Shanghai with a bang. We are a Chinese driver now, Zhou Guanyu, in his hometown race. So that was a huge event in April. The soccer teams, I think, were a little bit tentative doing preseason tours here, but I would expect some of them to come back next year. But what's interesting is that we've seen a divergence with the North American sport. So NFL has sort of decided that, no, we'll try to have an online presence, but nothing more. NHL, I think, has moved on past the 2022 Winter Games. MLB baseball has 3 developments, training centers, who have produced some good young talent. None of them have really made it in the majors yet, but I think there is hope there. I don't know that we're going to have MLB teams playing in China anytime soon. We saw one warm-up game prior to the 2008 Olympics a long time ago now. And then the NBA were coming year on year for many, many years. I believe about 20 games in a row they had preseason or 20 years in a row or at least a long number. And then kind of got their fingers burned back in 2009 with the tweet heard around the world about Daryl Morey and that whole incident. And so I don't know that the NBA is going to be coming back anytime soon, if at all. They've been fairly lukewarm, you know, when I've reached out to them to say, hey guys, what's the plan next year, the year after that? And no real firm messaging on that, even though the NBA is still huge in China. So what we're seeing now is international sporting events returning back post COVID, China hosting a number of big conferences, sporting events. It's still, you know, it's back on the global map as a sports country. But whether it's geopolitics, whether it's a combination of all these factors, the North American sports have adopted a much more hands-off approach. And so it's just kind of been an interesting dichotomy there.
Mark Dreyer, the founder and editor of China Sports Insider and the author of Sporting Superpower, an Insider's View on China's Quest to Be the Best. Thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
A pleasure, as always, Todd. And you mentioned you got your NFL draft later today. If I may just give you one quick tip, if you're looking for a kicker, I know it's probably not going to be your first round selection. Cameron Dicker, who is just signed a big 4-year contract with the Chargers, had the chance to speak to him a couple of years ago. Lovely, lovely guy. Really interesting story. He was born in Hong Kong and spent 11 years in Shanghai. So he's, you know, he's absolutely American. Wow. You know, went to University of Texas, but is a sort of Chinese born product who is doing very, very well. He was not drafted and kind of bounced around a few teams, but he's played very well with the Chargers, and they just signed him, I believe, a week ago to a 4-year extension, 20-something million. So really, really happy for him. Lovely, lovely
Good
guy,
for him.
And great to see him doing well. So sign him up.
Well, they call him Dicker the Kicker.
Yeah.
He became quite the riot when he first came in, especially because of his last name. Unfortunately, I probably won't be drafting him because the Chargers are unlikely to be a very good team. They don't have a lot of, they had quite the exodus of offensive talent this year and are looking to finish well in the bottom half of the league, most likely this year, unfortunately. So anyway, thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're listening to us audio only, please feel free to go check out the YouTube channel and the WPIC website. And if you are watching us on video and you need your eyes and your hands for other things, then flip on over to the audio only podcast on all your favorite podcast platforms. But for me and for Mark and for everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.